welcome to the PureMed Podcast special series, Behind Diagnoses Patients. My name is Leah Sarapier. I'm your host. Behind Diagnoses Patients aims to uplift patient voices, to share their insight and experiences navigating the healthcare system. It welcomes everyone from patient advocates, chronically ill, the disabled, and those with rare diseases to offer suggestions for a more equitable world. On this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Alexa in Winnipeg, Canada. She has cystic fibrosis, a rare and genetic condition that affects the respiratory and digestive systems. Alexa received a lung transplant and suffered a stroke during the transplant. She also runs an Instagram where she shares educational content and her story. She shares her insight as someone with a rare disease and as a young professional to provide hope for all those in the same place as her. Today, Alexa, we are here for you to tell your story in a way that communicates the good and the bad of our healthcare system, your concerns and suggestions for a more equitable world. So I'd like for you to take it away and tell us about yourself, your story, and what inspired you to become a powerful patient advocate.
Okay, well, thank you for having me. So I was diagnosed with cystic fibrosis at 2.5 years old. We didn't have newborn screening. I was born in 91, so we didn't have newborn screening back then. We do now, which is lovely. I was pretty, I guess, healthy until the age of 12. And I had my first hospital admission for a chest infection. And that started basically my life really deeply in the medical system, because after the age of 12, I was admitted to hospital probably every 6 months, and then it dropped down to every 3 months for about 2 weeks at a time. And then when I was 18, I was admitted for 3 months because of a chest infection, and I also had gastro. So I wasn't doing well. And one of the symptoms of cystic fibrosis is a lot of people struggle with weight, putting on weight, keeping on weight, because mucus blocks our pancreatic duct, because with cystic fibrosis, our issue is that salt doesn't move through our cells like people who don't have it. So mucus blocks our pancreas, it clogs our lungs, it can impact sex organs. Like, that's what the main issue is. I've primarily struggled with respiratory symptoms my whole life. But when I was 18, I was so sick, I wasn't eating. And then I got gastro, so that didn't help the problem. And I had dropped down to probably about 85, 90 pounds. And I'm only 5'2", 5'1", 5'2", so I'm quite a small person. Not quite small, but I'm short. And that was, I was in pediatrics at the time still. And I had been with the same team since I was 12, and I had gotten to know the nurses. So I knew I was in a comfortable place, but it's still scary to be withering away and not getting any better. And, you know, I trusted my doctors, but nothing was really happening at the time. And, you know, at that moment, I wasn't a really big advocate for myself quite yet. One, because I was so sick and I was quite depressed. And so my parents and my sister were my voices at the time. And that's, you know, it was a really difficult time. This is basically how I can just sum it up. And what ended up happening was my sister actually suggested to, it was either my doc, I think it was my respiratory doctor, to put me on TPN, and I don't know the actual long word for it, but, you know, it's an intervenous nutrition. She was in doing physiotherapy. She was in school at the time for physiotherapy. So she actually suggested to put me on TPN, and that is what basically saved me. The doctors were like, yeah, let's do it. Cause I didn't want a feeding tube at the time. I always struggled with wanting a feeding tube and needing a feeding tube. So I was put on TPN, And yeah, that's basically what started to save me at that point. And then the next part was, my doctor came in, my respiratory doctor, she sat on my bed and she's like, what do you need me to do for you? Which is something that I brought with me as I grew up, as I navigated the healthcare system as an adult. That's something that really stuck with me, because when she did that, she sat with me and she wasn't standing above me. She wasn't in, like, she wasn't acting like she was in charge of me, but she genuinely wanted to know what she could do. And at the time I was having so many symptoms. I was gagging every morning. I didn't want to eat. Like there were so many issues. So she actually ended up calling the pharmacist who came and spoke to me. And he is the one who changed my meds up. Other than my intravenous meds for my chest infection, he changed up different medications, put me on different. And that's when I actually started feeling better. And after 3 months, I finally got to go home and I had put weight on because of TPN. So that was a hard time for sure. And, you know, I find when I've spoken to a lot of the nurses who treat patients with cystic fibrosis, you know, they always say, you know, you're always going to have at least one really bad year. And that was my bad year at the time. So after the age of 18, things got okay. I was still hospitalized pretty frequently for 2 weeks because I had a Pseudomonas in my chest since the age of 12. So it's very difficult to get rid of Pseudomonas. Once it's in there, it's very hard to get rid of. And I was on a regime of oral ciprofloxacin, which I can't stand, but I'll do it, inhaled tobramycin. And then it was off for 2 weeks and I started it all over again. But it just, you know, it's a difficult bug to treat for sure. And there wasn't much other than the treatment and the IV that we could really do about it. And then I guess, so I finished university. It took me 6 years because I was sick a lot, but I had really understanding professors who were very accommodating with my illness. And then when I hit about 23, perhaps 21, 22, 23, my health started to get worse a lot quicker. So when I was discharged from pediatrics at the age of 19, I had an 80% lung function. And by the time I was about 23, I had dropped to 40%. And, you know, that's the thing about cystic fibrosis. That seems like a long time, but it's, looking back, it's quite quick at how fast my lung function was deteriorating. So when I was in my 20s and near the end of finishing university, so I graduated in 2015, near the end of finishing university, I was much sicker. I was on IVs a lot more frequently. I was losing a quality of life. You know, my doctors were great. At the time I had two main respiratory cystic fibrosis doctors that had been with me since I came to the adult clinic. You know, they were both, they're, one is retired, but I'm still with the other one. They're both fantastic. And I really got to know the ward. I call myself a professional patient because I have spent so much time as an inpatient. I know the schedules. I know the food. I know what happens when. I know the medications I'm going on. I know all of these things. But I have struggled with, there have been moments where I've struggled with being heard as a patient. And that's something that I, you know, now the last couple of years, I'm really trying to open people's ears about, and not in a negative way. But I've had a lot of experiences, and I know people think that sometimes I seem harsh against residents, but I'm not harsh against residents. I know that they're learning, but I guess because I've had such great care from my own respiratory doctors who I've been with for forever, I maybe set a higher standard. I don't know. But, you know, there was one specific time. I had gone on colistin, inhaled colistin at home to treat Pseudomonas. They wanted to try it out. And within about 36 hours, I was really struggling to breathe. It was something that I had to focus on. And so my mom took me to Emerge, and I was admitted right away because trouble breathing obviously is Emerge, but it was my chest infection. But I knew, like, there was something about that medication that I reacted to. So I was admitted, I was put on something else, because I said, please don't put me on that medication, I don't want it. And then a few years, or like maybe a year or so later, I was put back on it at home, and the same thing happened. And they tried to treat me in Emerge with Piptazo, but I actually had a pretty severe allergic reaction to it. So from that point on, I was like, you know what? I don't want to take colistin. Obviously, it doesn't like my lungs. My lungs don't react well to it. So I was in the hospital in 2015, right before I started my assessment for lung transplant. The residents had said, we're going to put you on colistin. And I said, don't, please don't do that. Like, I'm already struggling to breathe. Like, at that point, I was probably, my oxygen saturations were hovering around the high 80s, low 90s on room air. And I was already on, I was on a bit of oxygen when I was admitted, because that was usually my thing. I was on oxygen during my admissions, and that was about it. So I said, you know, please don't put me on that medication, because I reacted to it last time and I don't want that to happen again. And I was pretty sick. And they were like, you know what? Let's just try it. And I was like, please do not put me on this medication. It's like, I'm going to struggle. They're like, well, there's nothing in your chart about you having an allergy to it. And I was like, I don't think it's an allergy. I don't know. It just doesn't work well with me. I kind of felt pressured into that. And I was like, okay, well, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, well, I'm in the hospital already. I have oxygen here. My nurses are around. I'm in a safer environment. Maybe this time it will work. So I went on it, and within, again, 36 hours, my nurse came in and she's like, I'm not giving this to you anymore, because I couldn't, I had to put oxygen on, turn it up, because I couldn't breathe. And then the residents came in and they said, well, we're going to send you for another chest x-ray because we think your infection got worse. And I said, no, because I told you what was going to happen if you put me on that medication, and that's what happened. And I said, this was kind of around the time when I started being a bit more of an advocate for myself, because I was mad. I was annoyed because I felt like I was being looked at as the host to a disease that people were learning about, and they're going to see me one time and they're probably never going to see me again. And I said no. And then I think it was maybe this senior resident, I don't know, who came in and said, Alexa, we think your chest infection got worse, so we need to send you for x-ray. And I said, no, you got an x-ray last week, because I always did a chest x-ray when I was admitted, and I'm not going to expose myself to more radiation because people aren't listening to me. And that ended that conversation, because at the end of the day, I am the one in charge of the decisions that are made. And so I didn't have a great time with those specific residents. I wasn't feeling listened to in any sense. And so then what had happened was, and so the first day of that admission, I think that was about a week later, but the first day of that admission, there were five attendings who rotated, the respiratory attendings who rotated. And I had one, and my specific respirologist weren't on that week. So I had a different one, and he came in with about seven people. I didn't know at the time. They were all unfamiliar faces. And they came in, and he came in, and he's quite a loud, blunt guy. And he showed me Max received, Alexa, you need a lung transplant. And I have anxiety. I have pretty bad anxiety, and I've always had anxiety. I've had anxiety since about the age of 18, that first hospital admission. And I freaked out. I was alone. I was by myself. That's a very big conversation to have with somebody. And if he had maybe talked to my own doctors, he would have heard that my doctor, Dr. Perhonik, she had spoken to me about that the previous January, so about 10 months earlier, and I had had a breakdown. I said, no, I don't need new lungs. I don't want new lungs. This isn't going to happen. And at the time, I was about 30% lung function at that point. And he came in and just bluntly said that. And so I freaked out. I said, no. And I said, how dare you come in here while I'm by myself to talk about such a big thing with seven other people I don't know. And you don't even know me. You don't know. Like, it was one of the worst encounters I have ever had as an inpatient. And I told him to leave. And I said, you need to get out of here. I don't want to talk to you about this. I was just so frustrated that they would come in and say that to me. And perhaps there was this idea that, oh, you know, she's been in hospital. She's been a patient since she was 12. She's been here for so long. This isn't anything new to her. She's probably fine in the hospital. Like, this isn't a big deal. But that's not true. Like, being, yeah, I'm used to being in the hospital, but being sick, it doesn't make being sick any easier. Being sick sucks. And I know a lot of people can probably relate that even when they're sick, you know, they're vulnerable, they're sad, they're emotional. That can be with anything. And I was the same way. So he left and that conversation didn't come up for the rest of the day. And I didn't want it to. And I had talked to one of my nurses about it. So I don't want somebody to come in like that and bring that up to me. Like, in the back of my head, I knew it was what I needed to do. But at the time I was like, no, I don't, you aren't my doctor. You don't know any, you don't really know my history. You don't know how I reacted. Well, he knew how I reacted to things at that point. Cause I was becoming a louder, not loud as in the sense of raising my voice, but I was becoming more for myself. And I said, no, you need to get out. You need to leave. So it was a few days later that my doctor came in, my other doctor, he is now retired. And he came in and he closed my door and I was like, well, he's going to come talk to me about transplant because he's a man of few words. Like, he doesn't really talk. He was a nice guy, but he wasn't a really big talker, and he sat down, which was also new. And I was like, okay, well, this isn't, obviously we're going to be talking about something pretty serious. And he told me, he sat down and he said, you know, you're kind of running out of options for treatment for the Pseudomonas. I think at the time I had three different strains of it growing in my lungs. My right lung was, I called it my raisin lung because it was pretty much useless at that point. It had, the bottom lobe had collapsed when I was a teenager because of the mucus. So that lung was not a very strong lung. And it's your biggest one. So that kind of sucks. But he said, you know, we're running out of options as for treating you. He's like, obviously we can find medications from other parts of the world that are working and bring them in and treat them, but your really only option at this point is lung transplant. And I tried to keep it cool. Like, I was like, hey, yeah, okay. And I was kind of crying a little bit. And I appreciated the fact that he came in and sat down with me and he didn't stand above me again, like what had happened when I was 18, when my doctor sat beside me. And I felt more like a human, and I felt like a human with feelings. And my doctor at the time didn't do great when I was emotional. But, you know, I was crying a little bit and I had questions. You know, I said, is the Pseudomonas going to come back? And he said, there's always, you know, there's always a risk that it's going to come into new lungs. Cause I still have Pseudomonas in my sinuses. So I asked him questions and he said, you know, just because we do an assessment doesn't mean you're going to be listed. We just want to see where you're at. Because at the point, I was sitting at 27% lung function and I had no quality of life. I had to get around in a transport chair. And I worked full time. I pushed myself a lot. When looking back now, I probably shouldn't have pushed myself so hard. But, you know, I was always on IVs. I couldn't go places because I couldn't breathe. You know, there were days where I had to come home from work because it was just coughing so much. And I had to have a garbage bag beside me at work because I was at that point where I coughed so hard, I would throw up. So I really had no quality of life. It was dwindling at that point. So I said, okay, fine. Like, I'll do the assessment. And he said, you can do it as an inpatient while you're here, finish as much as you can, but you don't need to finish all of your assessment as an inpatient. We can do a lot of it as an outpatient. And I was like, okay, fine. So that day I had gone for chest x-ray, I had gone for CT scan, I had gone for a nuclear perfusion scan, I had gone for an EKG, and then like an ECMO, and I had a 24-hour urine analysis, I had all these blood work taken. I met the transplant, my pre-transplant nurse, Kelly, who was amazing at the time. Well, she's still amazing. I just haven't seen her in a long time. So she sat down with me and she came in and introduced herself and said, you know, I'm going to be your point of contact. And I'm going to do blood work once a month. And she talked to me about antibodies and matching and all of this stuff. So I started that. And like, I was by myself for most of those tests because, you know, I was 24 at the time and my family and my husband and I had a pretty good schedule for visiting. Like my mom would come in the mornings at around 11:30 and she would help me get up and then she would leave and come back in the evening and my husband would come back about 5. So I think this was about between maybe 1 and something. And I was always by myself. And tests don't freak me out that much. Especially at that point when they were related to something, I knew what was going on. I knew I had Pseudomonas. I knew my lungs were doing badly. I knew all of that. So these tests wouldn't really freak me out originally, but because I was by myself and because I had just made such a big decision to be assessed for transplant, it was a very stressful day. It was, and the minute, every minute I got back to my room, somebody else came to bring me for something else. So, you know, that night, and I had talked to my family about it and said, you know, I'm going to try this assessment. We're going to see what happens. Okay. And like, obviously everybody was very supportive and I got back to my room that night and I couldn't sleep because I was so anxious about everything. And I have a prescription for Ativan for 0.5 as needed. And I said to the nurse, I said, can I have a milligram tonight? Cause I just, and she's like, okay, I'll go ask the doctor. And she's like, they want to know why. And I was like, well, like I have decided to get assess for transplant, realizing that I'm in end stage lung disease and I'm only 24. I have no quality of life. You sent me for 1,000 tests in one day. Like, of course my mind is everywhere and I'm worried about what's going to happen if I do get listed for transplant. What's going to happen if I go for transplant? Will I survive transplant? What, like, will I go into rejection early? What's going to happen? And they said no. And that was frustrating because I find a lot that if you don't know the patient very well, you don't, I think our mental health gets put to the side a little bit or a lot. Sometimes our mental health is pushed to the side and it's only focusing on the physical aspects of what's wrong, what's going on in the body right now. What do, you know, the doctors need to fix immediately. And they're not taking into account how heavy this stuff can be. I remember calling we were married at the time, I called him at 3 a.m. and I was just crying. And I was like, this is like, I can't do this. So then I'd finished a bunch of testing and then a week later, I was ready to go home because I'd been in the hospital for about 3 weeks at that point, I think. And I wanted to go home. I didn't want to be there. I said, please get me home. I had finished 3 weeks of antibiotics. Like, I was better than when I came in. And the thing about cystic fibrosis is you don't go to the hospital to get better. You go to not get any worse. And that's what happened. I wasn't getting any worse. I was like, send me home. This has been one of the hardest, admissions of my life by far. I said, I want to go home. I want to sleep in my own bed. I don't want to be here. And so there was another attending on at the time. And she came in with a first or second year med student. And that wasn't uncommon. A lot of med students came in to learn, obviously. And I said to her, I said, send me home. Like, please send me home. She said, well, are you going to go back to work? And I said, yes, I'm going to go back to work. But she's like, okay, but you need to go back on a return to work, like a slow return to work. Like, fine. And there was this, it's kind of blurry, but it was just kind of like, I don't know what was happening. And then the med student said, Alexa, what if we send you home? You don't finish your assessment and you don't get your lungs in time. And then I lost it because the med student shouldn't have said that. because one, he didn't know me. Two, he didn't specialize in lung transplant or cystic fibrosis. Three, he wasn't considering my point of view at all. And I was very mad. I was so mad. I said, what do you, and I said to him, you know, my doctor, my cystic fibrosis doctor, who also happens to be a lung transplant doctor, told me I didn't have to finish my assessment in hospital. So why are you telling me that I do when you don't even know the situation? This is the first time I'm ever seeing you. And I was very upset. I was very, it was very uncalled for. For somebody to say that to me, especially somebody so, and I'm not criticizing med students, but it's very early in his medical training to say that to me. And so I was very upset. And she eventually, she's like, okay, we'll send you home and whatever. And I finished my lung transplant. Well, and I had gotten home and I had told all my friends that, or had my friends over, and I was like, yeah, I'm being assessed for lung transplant. And at that time I was coming around to the idea of being listed. And because my sister, who is a physiotherapist, she actually works with post lung transplant patients in Vancouver. So she has a lot of knowledge on this stuff. And she was one of the first people I spoke to when I was like super upset. And she said, you know, just because you're being assessed doesn't mean you're being listed. But, you know, she told me about the process. She told me about, you know, some of her patients are doing amazing. And so I was coming around to the idea that lung transplant was something that I needed to do at that point. And I think this was about early November in 2015. So I had my friends over and they're like, kind of quiet. I was like, guys, I'm not dying. And they're like, okay, thank God. Cause I guess I freaked them out. And I was like, you come over and we're just going to talk. And so I told them about it. And I told my employer and all of that. So I needed to get an angiogram before I was listed. Because my right lung was so tiny, my left lung was hyperinflated and pushing my heart to the side a little bit. So you couldn't even see it in my you couldn't even see my heart in my x-rays because it had pushed it so far. So I did an angiogram and it was fine. And then my transplant nurse called and she's like, okay, so they're going to present you to Edmonton because I'm in Winnipeg and we're a lung transplant center, but we don't have a surgeon anymore. So we do all of our lung transplants in Edmonton. And so she said, okay, we're going to present you to the Edmonton transplant team and they're going to talk about it. And then I was like, okay. And then I got a call and I'm like, well, what did they say? And she's like, so they want to talk to you in person because of the little meltdown I had when the first doctor had said, you need a lung transplant. And I told him to leave because it was a very bad situation. And she was actually one of the people there. So she witnessed it. It was like, oh my God, like this is, oh my God. So I did a telehealth with Edmonton and my transplant nurse and my parents, I think, and my boyfriend, who's, we weren't married at the time. And I said, you know what? That was a one-off thing. Like, that's not my, cause you have to go through a psychological assessment. Right. And I had done that. But that was something that was on my chart that I had freaked out. And I said, that was no one-off. If I feel like I'm not being listened to, if I feel like something's out of line, like, yeah, I'm going to react. And my transplant nurse, her name was Kelly. She said, you know what? I was actually there. And the way that it was presented to Alexa was not appropriate. She's like, I can understand where Alexa's coming from in that she was so emotional. So they said I was a great candidate. And they listed me for transplant in August or April of 2016. And then that May, I was very sick. I was also, depressed, understandably. And so I was back on antibiotics, IV antibiotics. I was the January before I was listed. And then again, usually May, all my life, May has been a weird year. So I was on IV antibiotics. I was losing my appetite. So I was losing weight, and my weight is a very sensitive thing for me because I've been called skinny my whole life. And I've been, you know, made fun of for it and people have criticized me for it. And that's a very sensitive thing for me and it affects me a lot. So I was mostly worried at the time because I couldn't eat anything because I was so nauseous that I would lose all this weight and they would take me off transplant list because you need to be a certain weight to survive the surgery. And I was so sick and I couldn't gain any weight. And they admitted me. I was admitted for one day. I went through Emerge, I think. I don't know. And Dr. Berhanek, who is still my doctor, she's also a transplant doctor. She came to see me, and she wasn't on rotation that week. And I wasn't on my regular ward because it was full. But she made an effort to come and see me. And I said, I was so tired of being anxious about eating. And I was so tired of being crying every time a meal came and I couldn't finish it. And I said, please give me a feeding tube. And that was the first time I never thought I would ever utter those words, because again, feeding tubes I always kind of fought them, because I felt like weight was something that I could control, but obviously I couldn't. And she said, yeah, I think we're going to put an NG tube in. The NG tube going in was horrible. Up the nose is not a fun way. It is awful. Luckily my mom and dad showed up maybe like 5 minutes before it was about to go in. So my mom stayed with me to put it in. It was awful. But that feeding tube, so it was giving me 70% of my daily intake of calories. And as somebody with cystic fibrosis, I was always told I needed 3,000 calories so that I could put on weight. And you always need a little bit extra in case of these times when you get sick and you do lose weight. So I had that in for a week and I put on 2.5 pounds. And I barely ate solid food that whole time, but just the weight of having that emotional weight coming off of me of not having that stress on myself to eat and having the feeding tube was amazing. So I said, when they just discharged me a week later, I think I had an appointment at the respiratory clinic the next week. And I spoke to the doctor and said, please give me a feeding tube, like give me a more permanent feeding tube. Because of course this happened. I got discharged and I went to see a psychologist, because I was seeing one kind of regularly at the time. And she had switched she had added an anti-anxiety medication. So ours was already on one, but she had added another one, or she had, it was something maybe for sleeping. I'm not sure. But it made me nauseous and it took away my appetite. And I started losing the weight that I put on with my feeding tube. And I was going back into that spiral of being unhappy and depressed and crying and making worst case scenarios. So I wanted a feeding tube. I said, please give me a feeding tube, like as fast as you can. I don't want to do this anymore. I was so sick. I had to go to my cousin's wedding, and there's a photo of me, and I'm very thin, and you can see in my face that I'm just not well. And we left early and went home. And then I think it was about a month later that I was discharged, that I got a call that they were like, yeah, we can put your feeding tube in now. So I got my feeding tube put in June. And I should say, so I saw Edmonton, I had to telehealth with them. I don't know if it was once a month, maybe. I can't really remember, but they had listed me at the time as a status one. So I wasn't in immediate need for lungs. So if there was a pair of lungs that matched me and somebody who was a status two, they would go to the status two first, because status two is higher. So they listed me as a status one because I was doing okay at the time. But then because I was losing so much weight and I was so thin and I was so sick, they said, I just like remember sitting next to my sister. And the Edmonton team they were always very great to me. They were very nice. And the transplant nurse there, she was amazing as well. He said, you know, we're going to up you to a status two. And that was scary, because that means that I'm getting worse and I need lungs now. Like I need them soon. And I said to them, you know, I think I'll be better once I get my feeding tube. I think I'm going to be better because I'll put the weight on. I know I will. And like, I didn't fight them for it. I wasn't like, no, I don't want to be a status two. Like, no, I didn't fight them for it. I said, yeah, I know. I mean, you guys know better than me. So I was up to a status two. And then I got my feeding tube and I loved my feeding tube. I miss my feeding tube. I don't have it anymore. But also, you know, it wasn't just that I couldn't put on weight because of my CF and because I was sick. I was using 70% of my energy on breathing because my lungs were failing so badly. And I was throwing up basically daily from coughing. So nothing was staying down. So the feeding tube was amazing. I loved my feeding tube. I was on 24-hour feeds the first little while. And then I was on nighttime, like 12-hour feeds. And then I was on nighttime feeds. And I was putting on weight like crazy. And it was insane. It was the first time in my life where I felt so happy with myself, with my body, because it was, you know, even people told me, like, you look healthy, like you look healthier. And I was somebody at the time, I was going to the gym a lot. I was seeing a personal trainer, like in between all my hospital stays and all of this stuff. And he was actually one of the first people after my family who I told that I was having a lung transplant. And he was fantastic about, you know, training me in a way that wasn't going to actually exasperate my lungs, but make me stronger with my muscles. Because he was like, well, if you're going to have surgery, we're going to have to make you stronger for that. And that's what you want. You want to be strong for surgery because you want to have a good recovery. And part of the pre-transplant rehab, I need to go to pre-transplant rehab, was with a physiotherapist twice a week. But because I was exercising, his name is Sherwin, I was exercising with Sherwin, my doctor said, approved that to be my pre-transplant rehab, which was fantastic because I'm glad that I got that kind of control over that. So I got a lot stronger because we only did weight training. And with my feeding tube, it was also better. Like my lungs were still failing. My lungs were still struggling. I was still struggling, but it was... it's funny. And I've heard this from a couple people who've been on a transplant list. I was probably the healthiest I've ever been prior to transplant, while I was waiting for transplant, because I was heavier. I was stronger. Was I still being hospitalized? Of course I was. My lungs were still terrible. But it was, transplant was very, it was a very crazy time because I was thrust into parts of the medical system I never thought of, like telehealth and having two teams. And at the time I was becoming so familiar with transplant at the time, not like I am now, but I was. And I actually had made the decision, every admission I had had, we had a senior resident who I just absolutely loved. He was there all the time. Whenever I was admitted that year, because I waited for 15 months between April and the July. I had this senior resident who was just so great. And every time I was admitted, I told him, I said, please don't let anybody come in here and talk to me about a transplant if they're not on the transplant team. Because that was a problem for me, was people talking to me about transplant when they weren't specializing in it. So they said that people would say, well, this and that for transplant. I'm like, you're not my transplant doctor. You're not my transplant nurse. You're not any part of the transplant team for lungs. So I don't need you to be talking to me about that. And I made that decision, and I'm happy I made that decision because it's probably saved me a lot of emotional, mental downfalls. And he said, no, I totally get that. Like, he never even spoke to me about lung transplant because he wasn't a specialist on it. Because at that time I was taking more control of what was happening with me and with residents and with doctors coming in. I was starting to take more control of what was happening because I was recognizing that this is about me. Like, this is about me getting better. And if I don't feel comfortable with something, I need to talk about it. I need to tell them because I'm done feeling like the host to a disease that you're learning about, that you've only seen in, that you may have only seen in a textbook before. That was very frustrating. I hate feeling like I'm not a human. I hate feeling like I am just an illness for people to learn off of, because I'm so much more than that. But that's something that I've always struggled with. And I've always told people whenever I've done presentations for med students before for Transplant Manitoba. And I said, you can't treat patients like hosts. Because we are humans, we have emotions, we have lives, we have other things going on outside of this. And we're going to be severely impacted by a choice that is made and what is happening. Bedside manner is so incredibly important. And, you know, a good friend of mine, we were really good friends. Like, we through elementary school and high school. And she, I just finished her last year of residency. So she's actually in Toronto. She finished her last year of residency just this past year, this past spring. And, you know, she always said she wanted to be a doctor, and she is the type of person who I know will be or is amazing, because she is somebody who has that bedside manner. She also saw me grow up sick too. And I'm not saying that I'm the reason she's amazing, because she has just always been. But like, I know she's the type of person who wouldn't treat somebody like just a disease. She's treating people like humans. And that's a really important quality for me, I know. And I think for a lot of patients who have trouble speaking up for themselves, like you don't want to be treated like that. You want to be treated like a human 100% of the time. And that's why I love my respirologist so much. She's transplant in CF, and she's amazing. She treats me like a human. And of course, she's known me for 12 years now, so she's going to know me pretty well. You know, being part of the, like, I basically grew up in the hospital, and I learned a lot about myself, about the healthcare system, about holes in the healthcare system, especially from a patient's point of view. And, you know, then, so I waited for transplant for 15 months, and then I got my call in July of 2017, and it was very quick. I was on an airplane within a couple hours, I think. I was supposed to have my transplant that evening at 6 p.m. and they had called me at noon in Winnipeg. So it was only 11 o'clock in Edmonton. So they sent me to Edmonton. My mom flew with me on the air ambulance, which was fantastic. It was a great crew that we had. It was two pilots and a nurse. I got to Edmonton, but that was also different for me because I've never been in the Edmonton hospital. I've never dealt with Edmonton like healthcare. So that was all new, but I had a fantastic experience in Edmonton. And it was my first time in ICU. And my nurse in ICU was most amazing. And the respirologists there were great. When we had gotten to Edmonton, my transplant got pushed back for another transplant, which was fine. So the doctor or the nurses, I don't know who took my family. So my mom and my dad and my sister and her husband and then my husband to tour the ICU and be like, this is where Alex is going to be. So I stood back, and there was a doctor, one of the respirologists was with me, and he sat with me while they were gone. He didn't leave me alone. And I said, you know, I was like, man, I knew this was going to happen because I had tickets to Edgerton this weekend. So I knew that something was going to impede my ability to go see it. And he was like, oh, well, I don't want to twist the knife, but I'm going tomorrow. And I was like, okay, well, like, they were very, very nice. He was a very nice guy. And I felt just very taken care of in Edmonton. But they're dealing with a highly sensitive part in somebody's life. And this is a huge deal, not only for the patient, but for the family. So I went for a transplant. They gave me lorazepam to go to sleep, obviously, because they were like, well, yeah, like, you're about to have major surgery, life-changing surgery, with there's this major question mark coming up. Like, am I going to survive surgery? Am I going to do well after transplant? What's going to happen with that? And then at 6 p.m. the next day, like, it was very fast. They just rolled me. They said, oh, okay, we're time to go. Because my donor was left on life support obviously they had to leave him on life support, him or her, for that. And then I went in, and, you know, I knew I was in really good hands. I didn't have a fear of dying on the table. That was not a fear of mine, which is weird to say, because it is one of the biggest surgeries you can get, is double lung. And that wasn't a concern of mine. I felt very, obviously I was scared, but the surgeon was a really nice guy. His name was Dr. Nagendran. He was a super nice guy. And they were all very nice when I was going in, and I said, and they were like, well, Alexa, can you lie down on your back? I said, no, I can't lie down on my back, because whenever I did, I would cough, because gravity isn't your friend when you have lungs plugged with mucus. They're like, okay, that's fine. And so I said, you guys better give me something quick, because I'm gonna have a freak out. And then the next thing you know, I was awake in ICU with a tube down my throat, which freaked me out. That was my only fear coming out of transplant, was my waking up with a tube down my throat. And I ended up having a stroke during my surgery. They think that when they were taking out my bad lung, they had to scrape it out because it was so sick. It was so diseased. It was so dead. They had to scrape it out. And I think that's when a blood clot dislodged, and that's what happened. And I had a stroke, and I was very lucky that I didn't. So my left hand is numb still. I couldn't move it before. My left foot was numb and I couldn't move it, but that came back within 24 hours. And then my left eye was impacted, but it's much better now. But I just pick up a blind spot now, which is, everybody has a blind spot. I just know where mine is now. And they handled the stroke well. It wasn't really much they could do at that point about that, because it had already happened. And I wasn't very mobile anyways, because I had tubes coming out of everywhere. I had 6 chest tubes. I had 2 IVs. I had one coming out of my neck. I had a catheter. I had, you know, all of these things. So it wasn't like I was walking anywhere. But Edmonton was fantastic. They did everything so well. The only problem I had was, had really bad back pain after my transplant. And I think it's because they open you like a clam. So you're kind of opened at your back. And I had very bad back pain. That was the most painful part for me. And I was on hydromorphone, obviously, because of the pain. And that's just a regular thing they put you on when you have that kind of surgery. And I think it was only I was only in ICU for about 4 days, 4 or 5 days. And then I was on the step down unit and I was still on a hydromorph. I had 2 chest tubes in still. So I was still in pain. And then they were giving me the, wasn't the IV hydromorph, but it was kind of like they injected it in my belly. And then one night it was really bad, but my nurse, I must've gone on break or something. And there was a different nurse, and he gave me the pill for him. And I said, what is happening? He's like, well, you need to go on these now. I said, well, nobody even spoke to me about that. And again, I was also on 50 milligrams of prednisone. And prednisone does not make people nice. It is a very hard drug to take and with a lot of side effects. And I said, no, like, and he's like, well, you need to take these. And I was like, I had 2 chest tubes and I had a very sore back. Like, I had never, ever expressed any sort of drug seeking behavior in my whole entire life. And I understand you need to get off painkillers. I get that. And then a few hours later, my regular nurse came to see me and she's like, I don't know why he did that. I don't know why that happened. So there was obviously some miscommunication in that point. But yeah, I mean, the rest of my stay was quite nice in Edmonton. They have a beautiful hospital there. And I went back to Winnipeg and I was in a familiar place, which was nice. They've taken me to 45 milligrams of prednisone, so I wasn't that bad at the time, or 40, I don't know. And I was sitting with my mom. I had just gotten back. We got back on a Wednesday afternoon. And I was sitting with my mom in my room and the residents came in with the attending or not, I don't remember. And the big thing was I had had a stroke. That was a big thing that people were talking about, which is fair. It's a big thing to happen. It's a complication that nobody wants, but you have to prepare for, and that's what happened. And I had a lot of people do the same test to me where I would close my eyes and they would touch one arm and the other arm and tell me if I could feel it. And I had done it so many times. And thankfully my mom was sitting with me because I was so emotional. I was just, you know, I had had life-changing surgery, had major surgery. I'm on all of these new medications that I'm not familiar with yet. My whole way of life is about to change. And I'm on steroids, high doses of steroids. And people kept doing the same test to me. And my mom saw me getting upset. And she's like, okay, you need to go. She's like, she needs to rest. You need to leave now. Because that's the thing too, right? You're not in the hospital because you're healthy and doing well. You're in the hospital because something's happened and you need your rest. And I needed to sleep a lot. And she, so thankfully she was there and said, no, you need to go. And he's like, oh, okay. She's like, she's had a lot. So just some, my mom, I'm thankful. She's probably where I got my voice from. And my, sometimes I'm a bit of a hothead. So sometimes maybe, but she's definitely somebody who has probably impacted the reason I am passionate and outspoken sometimes. So he left and she's like, no, you didn't need that at that point. I'm like, no, I didn't. I was starting to cry and I needed them to go. And, you know, throughout my whole experience as a patient, as an inpatient, as a outpatient, whatever, there have been moments where I feel like I've felt like not smart about my own illness. I've had moments where doctors have made me feel like I don't know what I'm talking about. But at the end of the day, like, I know more about my body and my illness and how I'm going to react to things than you ever will. And that's just a matter of fact. I'm not saying that I'm smart in med stuff. Like, there's a reason I didn't go to med school. It's because I couldn't hack it. And I'm probably not, or it's just not my thing. I don't want to go to med school. Obviously, you guys are going to know a lot more. But when it comes down to the person and the person with a chronic illness who has lived with this for their whole life, that needs to be listened to. That needs to be, okay, she's going to know about this. Like, when I told those residents that I was going to react to that, I knew I was going to react to that, but I wasn't listened to. And it made me feel small, and I don't like feeling small about those things. And that's a big thing. I mean, I advocate for people is, you know your illness, you know what causes your flare-ups, you know what's going to happen with certain medications, you know how you react to things, you know what's going to work, you know what's not going to work, and you need to voice that, because you know that better than the doctors know and the residents know. They will do their thing. They will give you medication, something like new things and whatever. They're going to treat you. But you need to voice that. You need to be adamant about, this is what is going to happen. This isn't what's going to happen. Like, that's very important. And I also say, like, I also remind people that you're in charge and you have patient rights. You have patient rights, and you need to remember those. Because I think sometimes they can be forgotten. Because there was a point in my life where I did ban, I don't want to say ban because that sounds very harsh, but I did not allow the residents back in my room. I had to call my social worker because I got very upset. And I said, I don't want residents in here anymore. And it wasn't because I didn't like them. It was because I wasn't being listened to. And that doesn't feel good, because I also want to be involved in what you are doing when it comes to healthcare. I want to be involved in what choices you're making for me, what you're putting me on and why you're putting me on it and what's happening. I want to be involved in that. And when you take that away from me, that makes me feel awful. So I did tell my social worker, I don't want them in here anymore, because I wasn't feeling listened to. And I think I tell that story a lot. And I think a lot of people think that I'm just a mean patient, but I'm not. There's a difference between being mean and difficult, and advocating for yourself. And I think people, that line can be blurry sometimes, for people who aren't in that position, especially if they weren't there in the moment. So yeah, ever since my transplant, I'm 4 years out now. So I've been, you know, COVID obviously impacted a lot of things. I exercised a lot, and I need that kind of push. So, and I can't go back to spin class and all this stuff, but I have been doing talks I do presentations for, I've done a few sociology classes for the healthcare system. I did like a biology class, and for Transplant Manitoba, I spoke to med students, which was something that I've always wanted to do, because I have the patient's point of view, and I don't know how much is taught. Obviously, I don't know anything about how med school works, really. But I love doing that, because I did get a lot of great feedback from med students. Because I got an email from Transplant Manitoba from comments that they made, and they said, no, I never really thought about it in that way when it comes to the patient, and that's going to make me think twice. So that's what I wanted. That's part, a big part of why I talk about these things, is educating healthcare professionals, future healthcare professionals, current ones. And yeah, I also count myself lucky though, because while I am a woman, I am not a very marginalized person. And I know that there are so many disparities in healthcare, and I'm teaching myself about that when it comes to race and sexual orientation and gender identity. There is discrepancies, and people are more vulnerable. And that's a super important thing, especially now, especially when we're becoming so, like, there is so much more, we need more equality in things, and in the healthcare system, especially when you're taking care of somebody. But yeah, so I am lucky that I am, you know, a cisgendered white woman, and that, did I always feel listened to? Not at all. I didn't always feel listened to. Do I feel like sometimes because I was female, was that impacted? Absolutely. Absolutely. I do. I can't really explain how, but, yeah, it's, you know, I haven't experienced a lot of it, but I know that it's happening, and that's something that needs to be talked about, which is great that you guys do. But yeah, that's basically my story in a nutshell, I guess. So yeah.
Thank you so much, Alexa, for sharing that and going into such depth from the beginning to the end and providing the whole summary. That's really amazing to see how you've overcome that, those difficulties, and how strong you've been the whole time, because the mental health aspect of things can take a toll on you without even realizing it.
Yeah.
So now we can dive into a few questions that I have for you, although you've sort of already covered them in your responses and your story.
Okay. But
what matters to you when interacting with health professionals or undergoing these invasive examinations?
Just being seen, like being listened to, being having, you know, empathy, like having my health professionals being empathetic and taking into consideration how something will affect my mental health. That is so important to me. Feeling like a human being is the number one thing that needs to be there for me. I don't like feeling like I'm, like I've said before, I don't like feeling like I'm a host to a disease.
Yeah.
So.
And it's very important that you mentioned that part of being a host to a disease or some type of specimen for health professionals to experiment on, and especially with a disease or a condition like cystic fibrosis. What can happen is they get very curious to see what works, what doesn't work, and then they forget that there's a human being, a patient in front of them. Yeah. So I'd like to say that we need to bring back the humanism into medicine that is often lost, and especially with COVID-19, for example, it's very easy to be seeing so many patients and then you really forget that there's a human being in front of you. And so now moving the question on to how can patients ensure that they feel respected, heard, and fundamentally understood in the eyes of clinicians?
Well, if you were like me and you kind of become loud, you just speak up for yourself. But there are also, in every hospital, there are patient advocates that you can call if you feel like something's not right and you feel like you don't really have that ability to speak up yet, to call your patient advocate. I think I did once, maybe when I was in pediatrics, perhaps. I don't remember. I think I did. But that's something that you can do. But remembering that this is your health and that they are here to treat you is important. Because then when you realize that, you're like, no, this is me. You need to listen to me. Mm-hmm. Does that mean sometimes getting a little bit more stern? Perhaps. Some doctors respond well, just talking. Some perhaps need a little bit more of a realization. Like, I'm not saying get mad and angry, but to be a little bit more stern, like, you are not listening to me. You need to listen to me. So, but I think that it's hard to learn to, like, it took me a long time to stick up for myself, and to be, even if you're brand new in the system, like, it can be hard, but it's possible. And you just gotta, if you're having trouble, call a patient advocate, call a friend, call a family member who you need, write questions down. That's always a good one. Because there, people are going to come back and see you if you're in the hospital. Mm-hmm. So write questions down. You're always going to have nurses there to ask. So, and maybe some, I think sometimes what I think in the past, what I've done also is I've asked my nurses if I don't understand something that's happening. If the doctor came in and I was too maybe intimidated, too upset to kind of understand what's going on, I would ask my nurses, because I have built a fantastic relationship with so many nurses that I've interacted with over the mm-hmm. years. And they can always come back and explain something to you. And oftentimes I feel a lot more comfortable talking to a nurse who I've known for years than a doctor who I just knew. So talking to, just asking your nurse, like, what did they mean by that? Why are they putting me on this medication? And they can always go check, right? Mm-hmm. So they're also great. Yeah.
And then, Alexa, this is a loaded question, but what do you think can be done to improve the healthcare system?
Oh man, that is a very loaded question. You know, well, there's so many different places that could be improved, right? There's so many different mm-hmm. aspects of the healthcare system that can be improved. Yeah. And it's kind of like, where do you start? But yeah. I believe everything starts with education, 100%. Mm-hmm. How med students are taught, how residents are taught. That's how everything starts, especially when you're talking, when you're focusing more on how to make patients, you know, how to make it better for patients. It starts with education. But, you know, our healthcare system in Canada isn't perfect. Am I super thankful for it? Of course I am. Of course, I'm so thankful for our healthcare system, but it's not perfect. There needs to be education on things. There needs to be education from people who are marginalized in the system, for sure. I think there needs to be a heavy focus on that, especially right now. But I don't, you know, it's funny, I'm starting my master's in public administration, and I've been focusing on healthcare and what can be done, but haven't started my classes yet, but it's something that I'm interested in.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's such a big question, especially to be like over Canada. Like if we're talking for me right now, what I'm kind of focused on, which isn't really included, it isn't included in our federal healthcare system, is medication coverage.
Exactly.
That's a big thing for me, because I pay thousands of dollars out of pocket for medication that I take to keep me alive for a disease that I did not give myself, and it is nobody's fault. Yeah. Like I didn't do anything in my life to give me cystic fibrosis. It's just the luck of the draw that just happened.
100%.
Medication is very big for me right now, because it's not okay that pharmaceutical companies make so much money off patients who are fighting for their lives, and we need to pay all of this money. And right now there is a struggle with Trikafta in Canada with cystic fibrosis, because the recommendations came out, because it's a huge, huge drug for Canadians with cystic fibrosis, with the most common gene mutation. I will not need it because I don't have sinus problems or weight issues right now. And my lungs, obviously I have new lungs, but the recommendations that have come out on who can and cannot access Trikafta is very concerning. To say that you need below 90% lung function to access that is not okay, because you have people who don't deal with respiratory issues. You have people who have lung problems or sinus problems. So access to medication is a huge thing for me right now over the past few years. And I was blinded to my own privilege before this happened, because I was actually on it was a specific healthcare plan that we had in Manitoba that I was grandfathered on that covered the cost of my medication. So growing up, my parents didn't pay for medication. And some of them, like one of my tobramycin was, my inhaled Toby was probably $4,000 a month. Hmm. And to think that if I had to pay out of pocket for that, like I couldn't.
Yeah.
And to make, you're forcing people to choose between their health and, you know, paying rent or getting groceries or anything like that. And that's not okay.
Yeah.
And So I was blinded by this because I was on this program, and then they got rid of the program. So I am on our manageable pharmacare system, where they take a percentage of your pre-tax income, and you have to pay that percentage out of pocket before the province will cover your medication. And you know, obviously it's going to be lower for lower income, but I pay, you know, people still pay groceries. People have families to care for. People yeah. have all of these expenses that I don't think are being taken into account at all. So I know I struggle with the medication costs, and I don't think it's okay that I have to go into debt to pay for medication costs. I have drug coverage through my work, but it's not fantastic. I use all of it up in a month and a half, and you have 12 to go, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm luckier now because my partner just got a drug plan, which helps a lot, but I'm still paying out of pocket, and it's not okay that people have to go into debt. People have to make difficult choices just to afford medication they need to stay alive. That's not okay. I don't think that will ever be okay. And it really very much bothers me. Like one of my anti-rejection medications, and I'm going to be on for the rest of my life, is $900 a month. And the other one is $1,200 a month. Like, that's insane. I don't personally make $100,000 a year. So that's not easy for me to do. And, you know, I had to think about going back to school. I'm like, well, is this something that I want to, because I'm already in debt.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the major problem at the moment is, for me especially, and I think that a lot of people, I know there was discussions at the federal level for a pharmacare program. I don't know what's happening with that. I haven't really been following it lately because I haven't heard much about it. So but yeah, health drug coverage is a huge thing and needs to be talked about more. It's important.
I think you've highlighted a huge problem that we do need, and especially mm-hmm. a national federal pharmacare program, I think we'll have it. And because the lack of access to medications, yeah. unfortunately, I feel it's causing a lot of families to have to choose between decisions yeah. they shouldn't have to be making.
100%.
So thank you for that, Alexa. And mm-hmm. the last question that I have for you is that if there is anyone who is too afraid to share their story or come out to speak about their diagnoses or to reach out to someone, what would you say to them?
It's easy for me to say don't. It's easy to say don't be scared, but that's easier said than done. Mm-hmm. If you're afraid to come, if you're afraid to talk to somebody you know or you're familiar with, there are so many resources online. If you have questions, there are a lot of people out there. You can find a lot of people on social media. And if you're somebody, sometimes I have trouble talking to people face to face. So social media has been great for me to connect to other people and talk about problems I've had and how they've come through things like that. And like, social media is a slippery slope sometimes, but there are ways to talk to people, get information that where you don't have to talk to somebody you know, perhaps, and you don't want to talk about yet, or you don't want to talk to about these problems yet. But also remember that your illness, whatever you have, it's part of your life, and it's oftentimes a very large part of your life. Mm-hmm. And it's also a special part of your life. I wouldn't be the person I am today if I didn't have CF, if I haven't gone through all of those things. And I am, while CF is really hard to live with, like, to a level that no one would ever understand, it made me who I am. And I'm thankful for that. And it's a very special part of you. And I can understand. I've always been very open about my CF. I don't know why. I just, from the beginning, I've always been very open about it since I was little. And I don't know why, but that's always helped me. And I can understand how it can be scary. Like, one thing I've spoken about is being honest with your partner about it. Because at the end of the day, if they can't handle it, then that's not your person.
Yeah.
Right. That's not who you're meant to be with. Like, I've had questions that I've had things that I've kind of been afraid to ask the doctor sometimes, but you kind of just got to rip that Band-Aid off, because they're there to help you and listen to you, and that's their job. And if you have a particular doctor you trust, and go to that person? But it's a hard question because everybody's so different when it comes to living with their chronic illness or their illness and talking to somebody about it. Because there are questions that aren't gone. There are lots of things that aren't gone over. I know for me, I had issues with my pelvic floor because I was coughing so much, but nobody ever really spoke to me about that. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of awkward to talk about, but it was actually my mom who helped me find help for that. But, you know, it's just, it's really easy for me to say, just do it. But remember that, you know, if you're scared for whatever reason, that, you know, you've overcome so many other things in your life. You know, you've overcome so many more hurdles than talking to, and I understand it can be big. I know it can be a big deal, talking to somebody, but think about how strong you've been in the past to do what you've done, to overcome what you have. Mm-hmm. Like, you can get through it. And it just takes time sometimes. It's a hard thing because everyone's so different. So it's very difficult to answer the question without being like, oh yeah, just do it, because that's not super easy.
No, but I think you've highlighted some very important points that can definitely serve as an encouragement or even some type of motivation. And it's never easy. Everyone has their own pace and own comfort level when it comes to telling anyone about their diagnosis or story. But there's hope and there's people out there. And even Alexa, you today sharing your story with us on the PMed podcast is going to impact and hopefully inspire so many people across the globe to know that they're not alone and that you've become such a powerful professional patient advocate.
Thank you.
And with this, Alexa, I just want to thank you so much for coming onto the PMed podcast, for sharing your insights. We hope that the Behind Diagnoses Patient Special series sheds light on the importance of listening to patient voices so that it can help inspire and change the way that the healthcare system, innovation, and care delivery is administered inside the clinic and beyond. So with this, thank you so much, Alexa.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Hashtag Rising Youth, the Government of Canada, Canada Service Corps, and Taking It Global for supporting and funding the project. I'd also like to thank the incredible individuals, voices, and patients who appear on the series and whose stories will guide medical education, clinical practice, and healthcare innovation. Listen in and listen now to the Behind Diagnoses Patient Special series on the PureMed podcast to ensure change for a better world. Catch us on the next episode in conversation with another incredible patient advocate. And if you need more information, do not hesitate to email us at puremedfoundation@gmail.com. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe. Stay healthy.